When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Wednesday, the 4th of February, 2026, and this is Reconstruction. I'm David Taylor, and I'm joined as ever by my colleague Phil Bishop to discuss some of the industry news from the past couple of weeks. Been quite an interesting period of time, isn't it, Phil? I mean, well, it always is. There's always something going on. What are we going to talk about today?
Well, our topics today, we're going to talk about industrial action on the back of these, the first day of strikes by the Wolf-Crane tower crane operators. Mm-hmm. Interesting that there don't seem to be that many industrial disputes in the construction industry. We'll talk about
that. Well, we'll come on to that. Yeah.
Another topic, we ran a piece about a builder being sent to jail for a year, not a suspended sentence as normally would happen for health and safety offences, but actually 12 months in jail, which is the whole question of what punishments are handed down by the courts is quite interesting, I think. We can talk about that.
Yeah.
And finally, we've had an email from a someone from a fairly well-known contractor just outside our top 100. I don't think we'll mention them, but they're asking, what is a tier one contractor? Do we qualify? You know, are we a tier one contractor? And I replied saying, couldn't tell you for sure, but here are my thoughts. And I thought that would, it might make an interesting discussion about what constitutes a tier one contractor precisely. The sort of thing, we think we know it, but when it comes down to it, there's not that simple.
No. Well, let's talk about industrial action to begin with, because I think we haven't really talked about this ever before, I don't think, because I don't know, construction doesn't seem to be one of those industries that is, you know, routinely plagued by industrial action. I mean, maybe back in the days of the 70s, the winter of discontent and all the rest of it, there was an awful lot more people walking off site. But these days,
well, I think strikes tend to happen, industrial action tends to happen in the public sector on the whole. I mean, it seems to be more prone to it, and maybe it's more unionised, but
yeah, it might be. But I mean, as you said, the reason we started thinking about this was this news report from last week about Wolf-Crane, which is quite an interesting company in many ways, because it's a bit different from most plant hire businesses. Because it's, I mean, Wolf-Crane, I don't know if many of our readers know, I'm sure a lot of them do. It's a German, actually, I think it's now headquartered in Switzerland, a German manufacturer of tower cranes, and their red cranes are a very familiar sight on construction sites all over the country. You said in your report, actually, Phil, that Wolf-Crane UK is the second largest tower crane hire in the country. And it made me think, who's the first? Is it Select?
I think it's Falcon in terms of number of cranes. Tower cranes. I think they've got the most. It used to be a rivalry between, it was Huden Tower Cranes,
which is
the origins of Wolf, because Huden was the notionally the dealer. They didn't actually deal in much in cranes, but they had an entire Huden Tower Cranes, and then became Harrington, had an entire fleet of red Wolf cranes, and dominated the market. And when Harrington went, the manufacturers, you mentioned Wolf, stepped in and took over the fleet.
Which is the unusual thing about it, really, because I mean, Wolf is a manufacturer of cranes,
but they also have a rental fleet in Berlin, certainly in Germany. They've got
I think they've got outfits all around the country, all around the world, actually.
They are in the rental business.
They're big, but anyway, I mean, there they are. They both manufacture and they rent and they hire cranes, and you know, tower cranes are, you know, iconic machines, really, because, I mean, they're so visible. And, of course, they are absolutely essential on a big construction site for your material handling.
Well, yeah, they walk out and everything stops. There's not much you can
do. Yes, exactly, which is partly why they do it. So, anyway, just to summarise, nearly 100 tower crane operators at Wolf Crane are taking strike action because they haven't had a pay rise in 3 years. Poor chaps. I mean, I don't know what the average salary of a tower crane operator is, but I don't think they're badly paid by most standards. But anyway, they say that not only are they not paid enough, but their employer is now seeking to cut some of their additional benefits, and they don't like that. So anyway, yeah, their first day of strike action was scheduled, I think, for the last Tuesday, the 27th of January. Anyway, and they'll be taking strike action every fortnight. One of the interesting things I thought about this was that exact days will be determined, I'm quoting your story here, exact days will be determined by members at each site based on what will cause the most disruption. I mean, I just wondered, that's not what the resident doctors do. You know, they're going to see... They don't time their walkouts to see how many patients will actually suffer as a result of this. But that's basically what the tower crane operators are doing.
Well, I'm glad the doctors aren't doing that. I mean, it would be...
No, me too.
But then they would lose any support. But you say you don't know what they earn. Wolf Crane themselves put out numbers saying that their top-earning operator in 2025 grossed just short of £110,000. Average earnings are almost £66,000. So it's a well-paid job. But I ran this and immediately one of the operators said, hang on a minute, you've got to do an awful lot of overtime and weekends and Christmas Day and whatever to get that. The base rate is basically 34-35 grand a year, which is still not bad, but it's not as much as a brickie or something. I mean, we had a survey came in this morning from an organisation who'd done a survey of average salary of different trades in the construction industry. They're saying bricklayers average £41,500, electricians £48,500, plumbers £45,500, average earnings, they're saying, for the trades.
Yeah.
So on that basis, crane operators aren't that well paid. But whether those salaries I've just read out include overtime, opportunity earn, I don't know.
Mm.
But crane operator is one of those jobs that the appeal of it is that there is the opportunity to earn well if you want to work hard extra hard.
As I said at the beginning of the discussion, construction in the UK doesn't seem to be plagued by industrial action quite like other things. The last time we reported on a strike, which was actually a strike which was averted, was in... September of last year. That was a strike at Tarmac's concrete block plant in Alfreton, up in Derbyshire. Again,
I wouldn't call that construction. I call that manufacturing.
Well, this is it. This is it. This is what I was coming on to. Because I think you think about strikes and industrial strife, and you tend to think about things like steelworks and mining and factories and transport. These are... I think the crucial difference here is that in these industries, these big industries, many of them, as you say, public sector, strike action seems to be more likely to occur, is where you've got a stable workforce, very often working out of a particular location, and where you walk off site and everything just grinds to a halt. And of course, the thing about construction is that we don't have that sort of continuity of labour. A site starts and then it finishes, and then people move on to another project, maybe even a different employer. And so you don't have the same sort of continuity. You don't have a stable workforce, which, when it takes action, can really just bring everything to a halt. So I think maybe that's why it is. People, and also we've got the question of self-employment. A lot of people who might be considered an employee. I mean, we're opening a can of worms here when we're talking about self-employment in the construction industry. These are people who perhaps consider themselves to be their own boss, whereas if they were working in, I don't know, in the rail sector or something like that. They might be an employee. So you don't get that sort of problem with an employer that you might get in other industries.
But also, I think a key word here is organised. It's not an organised workforce. And that's what it requires. That's what unionisation requires. And I've just, I did a quick search as to what, I don't know, I mean, Unite and GMB are the main construction unions. And Unite took over the union, UCAT, Union of Construction, Allied Trades and Technicians, in nearly 10 years ago, 2017. 9 years ago. And UCAT was the one union which was pretty much pure construction. I mean, GMB is fairly general, broad seated, Unite even broader. But if we go back to UCAT numbers, which we do have, go back to the beginning of the 1980s, and they had something like 350,000 members. By the time they folded, you know, went into Unite, they had about 55,000 members in the UK, plus another 6,000 or 7,000 in the Republic of Ireland. So from 1980 to 2015, 2017, they've gone down to, in fact, I think it was by 2017, I think it was less than 50,000. I don't want to say it folded, but might merge with Unite, because to lose that amount of membership, 350,000 down to 50,000 over the course of 30 years, was huge. And that's all to do with changing labour laws, to do privatisation of these big industries, outsourcing of you know, local authority maintenance work, and all sorts of reasons. And I think unionisation across the economy, I don't know how many people are members of a trade union across the whole workforce today, but it's not what it was. And if you're not in a union, it's pretty hard to go on strike.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, you're all alone. Have you ever been a member of a union, Phil?
I was briefly a member of the NUJ, and then I couldn't afford the sub. Were you in the NUJ? Are you still in the NUJ?
I'm still in the NUJ. For some reason, I keep, every month I pay £20 or something like that.
National Union of Journalists. You don't know.
Yes, and I was, and I have actually been on strike a couple of times, because back in the 1990s, early 1990s, Construction News, where I worked at the time, had an extremely militant NUJ chapel.
Yes, I remember that.
Was notorious for going on strike. And consequently, Construction News was one of the very last publications to adopt, to get rid of the typewriters and adopt computers, because we refused to adopt desktop computers until our employers had, negotiated a package with the employer, which included a very welcome Wednesday afternoon massage session to make sure that we didn't get repetitive strain injury. it's interesting. Construction doesn't have that sort of militant reputation. Quite interesting. I was looking back at some of the stories we've done over the past few years.
Well, Crossrail had a lot of action, didn't he? The electricians on Crossrail.
That's right.
Disruption, I remember.
Well, that was one of the interesting things about that was, not that long ago, actually, 2018. Not that long ago. Doesn't seem long ago to me anyway. It was one day action by 80 Balfour Beatty electricians. And they were, one of the things which they were upset about was, the dispute concerned, I'm quoting again, concerns a payment of an improved second-tier payment and a four-week finishing bonus. Now, I think that is the very construction thing, actually, this finishing bonus, which is payable to the workers when the workers are informed that they're about to be made redundant. So there you are. You know, they were working on a stretch of the Crossrail project, and their sector of the project was coming to an end. And when you've got a big infrastructure project like that and it's drawing to a close, they're supposed to get a finishing bonus. Because basically, they'll be out of a job when that project finishes. So they need notice so that they can go and look for another job. And they also get a bonus, and they wanted more money for that. And I can't see that happening in, you know, in with the resident doctors or with the train drivers or anybody else. It's very much an aspect of the construction industry.
Yeah, yeah. But would they have got redundancy as well as these finishing payments, finishing bonuses?
Well, I don't know because it doesn't say that. I mean, I don't.
But if they weren't if they weren't direct employees, they wouldn't be entitled to redundancy. So maybe it's sort of
probably on some sort of contract. I mean, presumably you don't take if you're building a tunnel, and you know that when all the civils work is done, you need your electricians to come in and put all the wiring in. You know that that's going to last. Well, actually, with Crossrail, it lasted a lot longer than it was supposed to. But you know,
it's
a finite operation, yeah. Isn't it? So you're not going to recruit somebody and then say, oh God, we don't need you anymore. You should be entitled to redundancy pay. No, you don't do that because you know that they're going to be redundant because the project will be finished. So yeah. I think redundancy here probably isn't the right term. It's probably the end of the contract. But, you know, at the end, it's thanks very much for all your hard work. Here's a bit of money to tide you over while you're looking for your next job, which might even be with the same, you know, could be with the same contractor on a different project or even a different part of the project on something like Crossrail. But, you know, that's... I suppose part of the package, and if you're in construction worker, you expect that package.
Yeah. I suppose other jobs where you are able to set your own rates within the constraints of the market, you know, like a jobbing painter and decorator or something, it might be in the mm-hmm. Domestic sphere, they would price the downtime into the jobs that they do. They know they're going to be working, they might only, you know, manage to get work for whatever, 35 weeks of the year or whatever,
yeah.
and they make sure that they're earning what they expect to earn on the jobs that they do.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can't do that in the commercial world and the B2B world.
No. There's another factor which I think is quite an interesting development because it's always been very adversarial. You know, you've always had the employer on one side and you've had the workers on the other side with the union representing them, but There are examples of, I think unions now tend to work more amicably with employers. They see that there's been a sort of a tendency for them to realise that actually they've got shared interests here. And this wasn't that long ago. Recently we reported that employers and employee representatives in Northern Ireland drew up a manifesto for boosting construction skills in the region. Of course, skills shortage is a major problem. And of course, it's in the interest of both the employer and the union to increase employment. The employer obviously gets more, a bigger workforce, and the union gets a bigger membership. So they set up something called the Construction Employers Federation, together with Unite and GMB, a company called Construction Industry Futures, which commissioned professional services company EY, that used to be Ernst & Young, to review the local construction market and bring forward a series of recommendations for talent intervention. So that was quite an interesting thing. You know, they're working together. And I think we see unions perhaps taking that role more often these days. There tends to be less strife, if you like, between the employer and the unions and their workforce.
I think we started talking about the train operators at one particular company at Wolfcrane UK. Yeah. It's interesting to compare how it works in the USA, for example, which is, it varies from state to state as to where unions are recognised or not, which is why you often get big manufacturing companies, you know, moving from the Midwest from Illinois to Arizona or something, or non-unionised stuff.
Yeah.
But the train operators there, and the riggers and the, they call them, you know, oilers, don't have oilers anymore, mm-hmm. but it's still seems to be a trade. The International Union of Operating Engineers, 400,000 members.
Good gracious.
I mean, they're not just the crane operators, but the crane operators are in it. But International Union of Operating Engineers. And in parts, I think it's the case in New York, at least, in parts of the States, they basically employ the tower crane operators, and if you want, and they make sure that they're trained, and they were involved in the whole operator certification scheme development of that in the USA, sort of what are we talking, 25 years ago. So you go down to Union Hall and get the operators from there, and they run the show. Well, they did. I don't know how strong they are today, but that was sort of the way it was not that long ago.
I think unions probably were always different in the United States, weren't they? What was the unions were very powerful, and they had links to, a lot of them had
links
to...
You're thinking the Teamsters.
Teamsters, organised crime and stuff like that. Well, I don't think any of our unions have ever had links with organised crime, none that I know of anyway. But it's a different sort of, different way of operating out there. But, yeah, quite interesting. There was another, I did notice another story back in 2018 that we ran, which again showed the union not really, certainly representing the interests of its members, no doubt about that, but sort of adopting a sort of a welfare role, where they launched a campaign for toilet dignity on sites, which I thought again was another very specifically construction orientated role for them. And because, you know, a construction site, again, a temporary workplace, obviously there are people providing excellent on-site facilities now, but on many construction sites, particularly smaller ones,
I would say perfectly adequate. I don't think anyone provides excellent facilities. Let's settle for perfectly adequate.
One or two yeah, all right then. But I mean, it's basically a porter cabin with a loo in it, but it'll be a heated porter cabin. Other mobile accommodation providers are available. Yeah, basically saying, well, you know, there's one toilet for a workforce of 200 on this site, and you need to improve things. And again, you know, another perennial topic of discussion in the construction industry is the role of women. And there was an example of, for example, there was a woman engineer on a particular site, and she needed a toilet. She needed a woman's toilet. She didn't want to use a gent's. And they provided one. When she went to use it, it was locked. When she got them to unlock it, it had been used for storage and she couldn't get in. So, you know, the union was sort of trying to address issues like that, which, of course, is not only a valid but very useful role for them to adopt.
I've heard of, in the not too distant past, of where any women on site have been expected to, you know, go next door to the local pub or something and just make other arrangements.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah. And so I think really unions have a very important role to play in the construction industry, but because, you know, working conditions are fluid, let's say.
It's very hard for you know, Johnny construction worker to kick up a fuss about something on their own, because they'll just be deemed a troublemaker, and they'll either be, you know, moved on, won't get promoted, whatever. I mean,
or their employment prospects will be...
It's a scar on your reputation if you start saying, you know, can we have soft bog paper, please? You're not allowed to complain.
Yeah. We should notice, actually, I mean, this is very, very timely, that, in fact, there is a new act coming into force. Actually, I think it is in force now. It got royal assent on the 18th of December, which is the Employment Rights Act 2025.
Oh, it's been watered down a lot, though, hasn't it?
Well,
and Angela
Rayne,
of course, is piloting it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so obviously that will affect working conditions on site. And there are things like... key measures include things like 0 hours, unfair dismissal, practice of fire and rehire, all these sort of abuses which people have had to get used to over the years. They're supposed to be stamped out. Trade union rights, there'll be new requirements for employers to inform workers of their right to join a union, which I suppose they've been reluctant to do in the past, and that kind of thing. So, you know, the risk of people walking out on site because they're not happy with their remuneration or their site conditions, perhaps will be even less now.
On the flip side, maybe we should also say, I don't know if it's true or not, but maybe the incidence of industrial disputes in the construction industry is down to more enlightened, touchy-feely management. Maybe, you know, construction bosses are getting smarter, nicer, fairer.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, as we've often noted in the past, a lot of construction leaders, you know, started on the tools, or certainly, you know, at site level, and they know what it's like to work on site and can sympathise with workers who feel hard done by or not paid enough.
Oh, do you think that's how it works? Do you not think they go, "Oh, it's all right for me"?
Yeah, probably.
It's good enough for me.
Well, maybe rather than actually become militant and go out on strike, they've just decided to climb up the greasy pole and get into management. I don't know. But at least they should know what goes on at site level. That's for sure.
I'm sure they do, but I think there's human nature is that if we go through something, you know.
Yeah.
Didn't do me any harm, therefore this is, you know, how the best way to do things.
Yeah. I think maybe some of the...
Right, I'm just saying it happens.
Perhaps some of the strikes we have seen in recent years aren't unrelated to the fact that we've got a chronic skills shortage. And I think maybe people will...
Yeah, you have to hang on to people,
yeah,
don't you?
You have to hang on to people. If they feel like, well, you know, I think I'm worth a bit more than I've been getting. And I've only been getting the same salary for a year now. I think I should be getting a rise. Well, of course, there were not a lot more leverage than if, of course, the labour market was flooded with people. So, yeah, that might be another reason.
There's been an awful lot of studies done about the younger generation. Two old gits talking here. the salary package is, you know, for you and I in our 20s, it might have been the dominant thing.
Yeah.
It's from what I read, it is less important to, you know, today's 20-somethings or even, I don't know, 30-somethings, and that it's the other aspects of the package, whether it's, you know, days off or ability to work from home or flexi time or whatever, the whole lifestyle thing comes into it a lot more.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Right, should we move on to our next subject?
Let's do that.
I was slightly surprised, and I'm not saying it was right or wrong. I mean, it's quite possibly absolutely right and fair, but I was quite surprised to run a piece from the Health and Safety Executive this week about a builder in a job on Staines upon Thames, as it must now call it. And it's in the photo shows, it's quite a humble little job, just knocking down a carport garage with a tiled roof on top, attached to a house. They're knocking it down to put up an extension. And as is typical for this sort of job, it was done in a very different way that a major household name demolition contractor might do it. Absolute lack of, you know, risk assessment, height safety measures, scaffolding, netting, whatever. And a 19-year-old lad was on the roof, pulling the tiles off, whatever. Fell through, smashed his head, died in hospital a few weeks later. Absolutely appalling. Tragic incident. The guy who hired the lad, the contractor on the job, was sent to jail for a year, 12 months. Magistrates, and it's a new power that magistrates have got. They've only had this power for a year or two. They used to have a maximum jail term that magistrates could sentence you to was for 6 months. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting about this, we've got corporate manslaughter. This isn't a corporate, this is an individual guy. But the idea that in a business context, it's sort of analogous to corporate manslaughter.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't done for manslaughter. He pleaded guilty to breaching Section 3 of the Health and Safety at Work Act. So this is the Health and Safety. That was his breach.
Yes.
He wasn't found guilty of manslaughter. He was found guilty of Health and Safety at Work Act breaches. Sent to jail for a year. And clearly, it was a cowboy job being done in a cowboy fashion, and it had tragic consequences. But jobs are done like this up and down the country, wrongly, of course. Mm-hmm. But that's how, at this level of the construction industry, things tend to happen. Now, if a health and safety inspector saw a job being done like this two streets down, they would issue, I'm sure they'd issue a prohibition notice, or the other notice, one of the notices.
Or an improvement notice.
Improvement notice. There would have been a prohibition notice on this one to sort of stop what you're doing, make it safe, start again.
Yeah.
The reason why the guy went to jail for a year is because someone died, which is appalling, but the offence is the same.
Mm.
Now, what is the difference between a breach of the regulations that results in someone dying, a breach of the regulation where no one is hurt, and the exact same breach of the regulation where someone breaks a leg?
Yeah.
Where no one's hurt, probably nothing will happen. Where someone breaks a leg, there'll probably be a hefty-ish fine.
Yes.
Where someone dies, normally, actually, I say normally, I don't, thank goodness, these sort of things don't happen that often. But in general terms, these days, we have seen, for this kind of offence, suspended sentences.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Plus, what do you call it, community service orders or whatever. Yeah. It's often quite hefty ones. You've got to spend every weekend for 6 years picking litter or whatever they do. So to see him just being sent to jail straight away, this guy, rather than getting a suspended sentence, should be a wake-up call, is a warning shot to every jobbing builder around the country.
Yeah, absolutely.
That this can happen at any time. I mean, the reason why, there are analogies here to motoring offences.
Mm-hmm.
Someone speeding gets a ticket. Someone speeding who hits a child and kills them will get much more than a ticket.
Yes.
Even though the actual offence is exactly the same.
Well, is it exactly the same? Because, I mean, the offence then is causing death by dangerous driving. It's not speeding. So.
But, well, okay, but it's still the offence is speeding. If you're speeding and you turn the wheel to hit the child, I'm talking about a small child who happens to run in front of the car.
Yeah,
you know, to chasing after a ball or whatever, and it's you can still expect probably a jail sentence or maybe whatever, you'll lose your life. I mean, the book will be thrown at you, and we're kind of used to it in the motoring side, right? You know, whether it's right that we it's not the prosecution. The sentencing seems to be based on the outcome of the offence or the crime, rather than the crime,
the breach of the law,
offence itself.
Yeah. No, I see what you mean. And
I don't know whether it should be. I mean, sometimes there can be a whole other things. There was a case near me recently where a motorist ran down, I can't remember, it was one or two people who were walking their dog on these sort of country lanes, mm-hmm. with no pavements, and killed them. And the motorist was, I can't remember the details, but got a huge prison sentence. Something like 12 years, I can't remember exactly, but huge. And I thought, you know, blimey, there, but for the grace of God. Turned out, when you read the fine detail of the rather than the paragraph, the guy had been going stupidly fast in stupidly dangerous conditions, and there are all sorts of other circumstances, showing off to a mate in a supercar, whatever. And you kind of think, okay, I'm no longer quite as sorry for you as I was. You know,
yes, quite.
That wasn't there, but for the grace of God.
Mm.
But it's exactly the reason why I wouldn't take any chances with drink driving. Because even though there'd be, you know, you might be times you've had a good meal and you think, oh, shall I have that, you know, extra drink? Can I do it? I think, no, because accidents can happen at any time to anyone.
Yeah.
That child can run out in front and you can do nothing about it, however sober, alert, good a driver you are, within the speed limit, whatever.
But if you're over the limit.
But if you're over the limit.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's on you, matey. You know, there's no getting away.
And this case was an especially egregious one, because the chap who ended up going to prison clearly had absolutely no consideration for safety at all. I mean, the list of conditions on site, which the investigation unearthed, was awful. So, I mean, you know, basically it was a fatal accident waiting to happen, and it did happen. But, I mean, did...
Well, so you wouldn't expect... No, you're right, of course, but in terms of human nature, I have seen many, I mean, not 19-year-old lad on a garage, whatever that is, 8 foot in the air.
Yeah.
You don't normally expect... You can die, of course you can.
Yes.
People have died from a 3 foot fall. But you kind of think you can get away with it. And I've told you before the story of where I'm sitting now, first floor of my house, spare room which I use as an office, got a little bit of flat wood. This room has a flat roof. It needed refelting a few years ago. I got, I've told the story before, I got three quotes and asked, are you going to put up a scaffold or are you going to do it off ladders? Two said they were going to do it off a scaffold, one ladders. And I thought, well, I'm doing what I do. I don't want to see someone falling, no, you know, past my window while I'm, you know, filing these HSE stories about whatever.
Yes, quite.
So I willingly paid extra for a scaffold job. Bugger me, the buggers came and, having me paid for the scaffold, they came and did it off ladders. And before, you know, they're halfway through and said, where's the scaffold? Says, oh, no, we decided not to bother with that. And that's absolutely typical. Yeah. And this is, you know, two stories up. Not the highest thing in the world, but you do serious damage.
Sure.
There was absolutely no fall protection, nothing. No. They just, you know, and they probably do three jobs a day like that. And that's how an awful lot of the, you know, the job in construction industry works.
Yeah.
And if they read this story, if they saw that this guy had gone to jail for a year because someone had happened to fall, I don't think they would ever do that. I hope they would never do that again. I hope they would put up a scaffold.
No. When we report legal stories on the Construction Index, very often they tend to be very different sort of stories to this. It's usually about contract law or some dispute, and it's, you know, it's the we discussed it last time, the Technology and Construction Court. Their decisions, which are made in the High Court, they create a precedent, and so they talk about case law a lot. I wonder, in a case like this, where you've got Ashford magistrates, was it there? I don't know. I think, yes, it was in Middlesex. Magistrates decided to send this chap to prison for a year for this breach of the law, as you say, the Health and Safety at Work Act. Is there any likelihood that that would be consistent across the UK, that other local magistrates would consider it, consider the same penalty for that offence?
There are sentencing guidelines. It might give other magistrates, if they hear about this, you know, a bit of backbone, a bit of spine to say, actually, you know, we need to come down harder on these things. I think it's up in, although it's the Lord Chancellor, wasn't it, who had sort of set the sentencing guidelines. But it was just last month, for example, we ran a story about someone fell 15 feet through, so twice the size of what we're talking about, through a skylight during roof repair work. And the company involved in that case was fined £80,000. The guy didn't die, multiple fractures, badly injured, £80,000 fine. But as I say, it seems that they're only interested in prosecuting when someone is hurt or someone is killed.
Yeah.
And the agency say, oh, we're going to prosecute. There is an odd exception to this, I was going to say rule, I don't mean rule, generalisation, reported just in November last year, where a guy got a 12-week prison sentence suspended for a year. Okay, it's more typical.
Yes.
But here, and this is for breach, here, this is a client on a small refurb project, well, I don't know how small it was, on a refurb project. This is for breach of the CDM regs, the Construction Design and Management Regulations, for breaching his client duties to make suitable arrangements for the project being, you know, being
set. Was this a commercial job or was it a domestic?
It was, I think it was in a synagogue. Yeah, it was a commercial job.
Oh, right, okay.
It wasn't a domestic job. No one was hurt.
Right, okay.
But what happened was a body was found. Someone died on the site. Synagogue development in Hackney. A body was found, or I don't know if he died of natural causes on site. HSE came to visit. Yep, natural causes. He wasn't, you know, he didn't fall off a ladder or anything that. Natural causes. But while they were there, the HSE looked around and saw multiple safety failures on the site. And so they decided to take action.
Yeah.
They don't normally do that. In any other case, had there not been a dead body on the case and therefore eyes on the site, they would have, I damn sure it would have been improvement notice, prohibition notice, that sort of thing. That's what they normally do when they find safety failings when no one's hurt. On this case, no one was hurt, but someone had happened to die of natural causes on the site.
That's interesting.
And they go, ooh, dead body, we better do something. Prosecution. So the guy gets a suspended jail sentence. We're all on the side of making the construction industry safer. So I'm not going to say, oh, they should have let him off. But it, doesn't seem terribly consistent.
Yeah,
to
I know
me.
What you mean. Well, if there's any health and safety experts listening, I'd love them to get in touch with us and let us know whether or not you are right, Phil, that spotting health and safety breaches which haven't yet resulted in an injury are always result in an improvement notice or a prohibition notice, or whether there are examples of people being prosecuted just for having an unsafe site that hasn't actually killed or hurt anybody yet. But you're right. Normally, we do get stories where, for example, HSE inspectors have turned up twice or even three times to find that the improvement notice, which they served the first time they turned up, has been ignored. In fact, I think there was recently one.
The James Bond guy again.
Yes, that's right, yeah. One chap who just kicked off and refused to give his name, called himself James Bond, and just basically treated the inspector to a mouthful of invective. He was obviously prosecuted. Can't remember what the outcome of that job was. But it's interesting.
He was fined $3,000 plus costs of $6,500.
Oh, richly deserved from what I remember of that story. But I mean, maybe the HSE should be prosecuting people for, you know, not having scaffolding on a roofing job or not having any fall protection or having exposed electrics or exposure to asbestos, rather than telling people to clear this up and we'll be back to make sure you've done it. Maybe they should say, right, you know, you're nicked, son.
And if you are thinking of breaching health and safety law, the place to do it is Northern Ireland, where the sentences seem to be a lot less. Just looking at a couple of cases they had last year, August 2025, a property maintenance company in a court in Manchester for breaching asbestos regulations was fined £5,000 mm-hmm. plus £5,000 cost. A company in Northern Ireland in December for breaching asbestos regs was fined £500.
Wow.
Now, admittedly, the asbestos regs are slightly different in Northern Ireland in terms of the what they're actually called, but it's the same, you know,
same
basic
offence. Yeah,
and it's breaching asbestos regs, tenfold fine in Manchester than in Northern Ireland.
Mm, yeah, interesting. It sounds perhaps as if we're accusing the HSE of letting people off lightly by not prosecuting them the minute they see something gone wrong, but.
Wait, it's also the CPA. I don't know how much the HSE. It might be the CPS.
Well, yes, that's true. Good point. And there are some offences which are taken so seriously that there's usually very serious penalties. And I'm thinking specifically of gas work, because you can quite regularly, actually, we get press releases from the HSE talking about somebody they've prosecuted for doing unsafe gas work. It's maybe they've installed...
You're right.
They will install a boiler.
That does happen.
And the boiler might even be working perfectly well, but they're not gas-safe registered. They're not actually entitled to do the work. And they will get absolutely hammered.
You're right. That is a good point. That is an example where it doesn't take someone to be...
No.
Harmed.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't take someone to be harmed, gassed. It doesn't take the house to blow up for action to be taken.
Yeah.
If someone who's not gas safe registered, you know, fiddles around, then they will be done.
Yeah.
Regardless of the outcome. There it is, the breach that's penalised.
Yeah.
So maybe there are other examples, but that's a good pickup.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've just had my gas boiler serviced, and the lad who came round...
Me too, there's coincidence. You know,
always happens in January, Phil, don't you? You always get it done in January. Yeah, and the lad who came round, I'd never used him before, because the chap who I used to use in my village is retired. This lad, young chap, I emailed him and said, you know, can you bring your paperwork? I want to check that you're gas safe registered. And I felt like, you know, a right old fuss pot doing that. But I said, yeah, I'm sorry. When he turned up, I said, look, I'm sorry, but I can't in all conscience, like you with your flat roof, I can't in all conscience do my job and report on breaches like this and not actually be absolutely squeaky clean when I'm employing a plumber to do gas work myself. And he was fine, absolutely fine. And in fact, I think he actually quite appreciated the fact that, you know, he's jumped through hoops to get his gas safe registration, and it's quite good that he was able to demonstrate that he'd done that. Nobody usually asks.
No, I agree. It shows that it means, he'd be saying, yes, it means something.
Yes,
I did do it for a reason.
Yeah. So there we are. Fingers crossed that my boiler doesn't blow up now, but No, it's fine. You did a good job. You did a fantastic job.
It's gas safe registered.
Yeah. Move on to our last topic for the day.
Let's do it. This was, as I mentioned at the beginning, an email I received from the communications chief of a pretty well-known construction company, certainly one that I've heard of.
Yeah, they built my local health centre, not health centre, sports, leisure centre. Yeah, very well-known.
We are £163 million turnover, 270 staff, work across Midlands, South West, a bit into Wales, a bit further north. So, major regional, pan-regional player. Mm-hmm. 163 million turnover puts them just outside our top 100 of contractors by my reckoning. It might put them in it next year.
Yes,
actually.
Yes, it might.
163 million just qualified, number 100 in our list was 163 million last year. So they're around that mark. And he said, it probably sounds obvious, this question, but what would you class as a tier one contractor? I feel we're on the cusp and want to be as clear as possible for staff. So I'm just wondering how you perceive it as someone who writes about tier ones regularly. Is it based on turnover, geographical reach, staff numbers, or what? And my reply said, I don't know if there's an official answer. There may, maybe Build UK or the National Federation of Builders might be, better place. They might have an authoritative, this is what we define as tier one. But I said, my general understanding is a tier one contractor is a contractor at the top of the food chain. They're paid by the client and then the money goes from them to subcontractors or, there might be tier two, tier three packages, subcontractors down the supply chain. But that only works if the job's of a certain size, a major job. But then I don't know what a major job is. And if it's something, if it's a sub £5 million job that you're doing, I don't think you would call yourself a tier one contractor. You're just the contractor. So I kind of figure there must be a contract value threshold that you're taking on. And I don't know what that would be. 20 million, $50 million? I don't know.
Again, I think it's very arbitrary, really.
And I said, I don't think nationwide coverage is a key consideration. I think that, certainly in Scotland or Northern Ireland, you can be a tier one contractor, absolutely, without necessarily being active in London. And I said, of course, some companies are tier one and tier two, that they have different bits that they've, they may be started off as a slip form concreting contractor and have moved on to do the main contracting role, but they still... Sometimes they work as the main contractor, sometimes as a subcontractor.
Yeah.
And I thought, hang on a minute. I know someone who knows the answer to everything. Google.
Yeah.
So I Googled it. And I said, what is a tier one contractor? In the UK, I say, in case there's different things in different areas. And they said a tier one contractor or main contractor is a large, experienced construction company that directly manages massive, complex projects like airport stadiums or major infrastructure for a client, taking responsibility for delivery by hiring and coordinating smaller tier two. Well, I know all that. That doesn't help me. What, how complex,
there's no measure.
How massive?
It
says key characteristics, big jobs, direct relationship with the client, does the project management. And it says resources. This is apparently, according to Google AI, a key characteristic of a tier one contractor: possesses significant financial strength, a large skilled workforce, and advanced technology. And I'm thinking,
advanced technology! I didn't know that was a criterion.
A lot of equipment. They don't have a lot of tier one contractors don't have a great deal of financial strength, unfortunately. In fact, they're teetering on the brink, many of them.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't accept that the financial strength, a large workforce, a lot of them subcontract everything out, and advanced technology is a criteria for being a tier one. So I don't accept that.
I think that it depends on your perception and where you, you know, where you're speaking from. I did a bit of Googling as well. I didn't ask Google itself. I looked for some companies which might be able to shed some light on it. I found one company which actually had on its website quite an interesting article, headlined, "What is the difference between a Tier 1, 2 and 3 contractor?" I'm going to quote a little bit from this. It says, "When it comes to construction projects, understanding the different levels of contractors is critical. You may have heard of the terms Tier 1, Tier 2 and Tier 3, but what do they mean? In this article, we discuss the difference." Anyway, Tier 1, general contractor.
Come again? Where was this article? What's this?
It was on a contractor's website.
Okay.
Okay. And so...
Not a university thing.
No. This is a contractor.
Right. Yeah.
"A Tier 1 contractor is commonly referred to as a general contractor. They usually have decades of experience in their field and often take on large-scale building and infrastructure projects, such as commercial offices or major highway renovations." And it says Tier 2 contractor is also known as a subcontractor. They typically specialise in one particular aspect of a larger or mid-sized project, like mechanical and electrical maintenance work. Tier 3, speciality contractor. "A Tier 3 contractor is the lowest level of subcontractor and sometimes referred to as a specialty contractor. This is because they work exclusively in one particular type of construction." Then they finish up by saying, "We take care of everything. Operating as both a UK general contractor and subcontractor, our team of qualified civil engineers and construction specialists are dedicated," et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know where this is going. This website is on a contractor. It's an, as you might have gathered, a mechanical and electrical specialist with a turnover which I understand is approaching 40 million. So they would be an SME by our measure.
They're claiming
Tier 1 status on some projects and Tier 2 on others. So, you know, they think they know what a Tier 1 contractor is, but a lot of other people would say, no, they're not Tier 1.
But I suppose if I'm having a cat flap fitted and the bloke comes to fit the cat flap and he gets someone else to hold his screwdriver while he's getting down his hands and knees, then the guy holding the screwdriver is a subcontractor and the guy fitting the cat flap is a Tier 1 contractor.
Well, I guess so.
Technically. Well, not on the big jobs side of things, but...
It's interesting. I mean, I looked again, you know, SCAPE, SCAPE, which is the organisation that...
Framework agency.
The frameworks. Yeah. A lot of these, you know, obviously, they should know what a Tier 1, Tier 2 and Tier 3 are. So their definitions, Tier 1, Tier 3, Tier 2 and 3, what's the difference? Tier 1, large project types, large-scale national construction and infrastructure projects and developments with significant budgets. Company size?
How large? What budget?
Well, it doesn't say. Company size, large, multi-million pound turnover. Well, 40 million. 40 million is multi-million.
That's very multi.
Tier 2 is mid-sized construction projects. Well, this is another thing, you see. They don't even acknowledge that a Tier 2 contractor is sometimes a subcontractor. What they seem to suggest here is that a Tier 2 contractor is also a main contractor on a mid-sized construction project, for example, commercial, education and residential. Company size, medium size. Tier three. They're the blokes building your shed. Small and local construction projects or specialist expertise, SMEs and small businesses. So that's your cat flap. So I thought I'd get a far more exhaustive.
They're basically saying,
more,
if you're big, you're Tier 1.
Yeah,
if you're mummy bear, you're Tier 2, and baby bear's Tier 3.
Yeah, exactly. I thought SCAPE would probably be more helpful. But, yeah, I think all that demonstrates is that nobody really knows. It's just you know it when you see it, basically.
Maybe we should set a rule.
Yeah, maybe we should.
Can't think what it is. Answers, please, either by on a postcard or by email to podcast@theconstructionindex. If you send a postcard,
don't bother.
Just email, but do email podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk with what your definition of a Tier 1 contractor is or should be. Mm. And let's see if we can't come up with something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that'd be interesting.
Because what we've got so far ain't good.
None
and if
the
even...
wiser.
A 160, what did I say there? 167, 170 million turnover main contractor who's doing pretty big jobs like your local leisure centre.
Yeah.
If they don't really know whether they qualify as Tier 1 or if they think that might sound like bragging if they call themselves Tier 1, then
I mean, probably nobody.
Maybe it
knows.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. But they, you know, people would like to know, even if they don't.
Yeah. Well, I suppose as long as we're using those terms, then we ought to at least justify the use of them. So, yeah, any information that people can provide will be gratefully received.
Otherwise, you have to start deleting. It's like every time we have a press release with the word expert.
Yeah.
Someone's an expert on something. Go, nope, delete that. That means nothing at all.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Meaningless word. Right. Any other business, David?
There's nothing that immediately springs to mind. No, don't think so. What about you? Anything to add?
I'm just checking if anything's hot off the press, and I don't see anything. So let's reconvene this time in 2 weeks' time.
Indeed.
Valentine's Day in the meantime, David, where are you taking me?
Well, I'm not taking anybody anywhere, actually, for I'm sorry to say, because my wife has deserted me. She's gone to Tenerife for 5 weeks.
Wow.
She says she can't stand the winter in Devon anymore. So she's booked herself an apartment in Tenerife, and I won't see her until, well, I'll be going out there at the end of the month to join her. But
You're not good with the heat, though, are you?
I'm not good with the heat. But I think Tenerife in February is not. It's not going to be roasting, is it? But yeah, so yeah, the 14th of February, I'll be on my own.
I'm just going to get out my tiny violin.
Yeah, no, I'll be doing that. Okay.
Well, thank you very much, everyone, once again for listening. And yeah, as I say, we'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time. And until then, have a very lovely time. And I hope you're not spending Valentine's Day alone, as David will be. Or so he says. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.